So once again, Dan Dutt, he's going to speak on the formation of the boy, 38 years, coaching.
Gentlemen, how are you? Good. I have to tell you, candidly, I'm talking to men who are studying the youth, and pretty much, I have to tell you, I'm amazed truly at the intellectualism in the room. I mean, you guys are smart. You know, and I'm in the business of the kid business of bringing boys to men in the locker rooms, which really is very oftentimes does support the stereotype that football players may not be so intelligent, but we do have our mix, and you know, there's a position for everyone on the football field. You know, that's the beauty of the sport. I played three sports, and I often will go recruit a kid in the hallway that's a basketball player or a baseball player, and I'll say, look, there's a position for everybody in the game of football. There's a place for you. And that's a great analogy to life itself, you know, that you can serve a purpose on the football field. Even if you don't get on the field, you can serve a purpose to the energy of the team in the locker room or in the chemistry of the locker room. I really hope to bring to you today the true humanness of football, kind of get you into the locker room. Many of you have not been in the locker room, and if you have, I'm going to try and get you into my locker room, which I took too long for me to do it, but my locker room became unique by the grace of God and by some life experiences. I'm going to stick close to my notes, which is something I don't often do. If I had notes in front of me when I was talking to a football team, they'd probably stop listening to me, because it has to come from your heart, and it's got to be real. But in order for me to run deep with a couple of themes to my talk today, and Dr. Chavez has led me to run more deeply with some themes with our group here and really, really took me out of my comfort zone, thankfully, I'm going to stick to my notes a little bit more than I'm used to. So this talk is really a manifestation of several attempts to capture a profound level of supportive content for the title of The Impact of Sports in Bringing Boys to Manhood. Once again, Dr. Chavez returned several submissions as I was not being representative of my true inner self. In his intuitive nature, he said, take it back, rewrite it. Mark said, take it back, run deep. And truly, that was really a contradiction to what I teach my own football players, is to be yourself. And otherwise, it's so tragic if you're not. So I will surely be Coach Duddy, not dad, a little bit of dad, not hubby, poopsie oopsie. She does not call me poopsie oopsie. But for the next 3 hours, I'm just kidding. No. I went to college in order to become a classroom teacher so that I could then coach football, because I truly believe that coaching is teaching at its best. I wanted to bring boys to manhood because that is what football did for me. Algebra did not bring me to manhood. So I kind of have an undergraduate degree in shut up, get up, huddle up. Then I moved along on my journey and I got my master's in get up, huddle up, talk to me. And then way too late in my coaching career, I got my doctorate in I love you, I'm listening, I also have something to say to you, let's be men together, and everything else will take care of itself. This opportunity to present at the Masculine Genius Institute, especially given this topic, has uprooted some profound sentiments as I have recently spent my first fall without football. I've been home, being a husband, and my wife has yet to throw me back to the football field. She did once in my career, though. I retired last spring, and I don't like the word retire. I'm always listening. So I speak this to you from my heart to yours, and you will gain real story-based insights from my personal journey that stems from a newborn baby's self-awareness to the masculine trait of independence that comes from the realization of a fulfilled feeling of self-knowledge. I will also draw to some degree on comparisons between my relationship with my own father and my own high school coach, and provide insights on how that interaction positively and negatively affected my coaching career with regards to personally gaining a personal independence, then instilling that to the players in my keep. having had 48 football seasons as a player and a coach, well, let's just say I had 50. It sounds more dramatic. I'm at 61, so we'll add two to round it up. I have gathered a few, for our purposes here, pertinent, passionate, heart-wrenchingly tragic, and triumphant accounts of how, by the sheer nature of just playing the game, can naturally launch an amazingly positive platform for masculine injection. But I will also share with you that to a large degree, as a player myself, that is not the case with me. Due to some very challenging consequences as a player and coach, I came to an understanding and resolved to hold myself accountable to my incredible influences on my players. And that's when I became intentional about forming boys into men. I was no longer just a spectator to either their journey or mine. I became deeply aware that I too was in fact on a journey with them, and that it was in fact necessary that we, player and coach, plunge into that journey together. I will reference our Bible regarding David, among the greatest journeys ever told, and I'll touch upon briefly Socrates' views on the realization of self-knowledge through introspection, and how that launches boys to manhood via the onset of independence. I will also draw briefly on supportive commentary from Matthew Kelly and C.S. Lewis. I will operate from the premise that no true profound level of self-knowledge resulting in and commensurate with a true independence can be found without resolve to uncomfortable actions. And I'm also going to share with you the real life stories of number 41, Lewis Brown, and number 52, Brian. I'm going to draw on faith in God and creation as a main catalyst for true self-knowledge and independence, and present briefly a comprehensive model offered by the Catholic Athletes for Christ as part of my personal journey, and how it intentionally brings boys to manhood, told through the experiences with and of those two players, Lewis and Brian, and how we all became formed together and by each other. My self-awareness was an overtime. I'm really going to kind of let my hair down with you guys today, which is not an easy thing for a man to do. As you can see, it's been let down. I was recently awestruck more than ever, even after seeing the births of my very own 8 children, by observing the very first few hours of my first grandchild. He's 8 months old today. It brought back vivid memories of what wonderful eye-to-eye contact that is so natural in us from birth, creating a depth of intimacy that is truly miraculous. We witness the very being or souls of the newborn as we marvel at the amazing beauty of such young and dependently fragile and soft bodies, who just minutes before was so dependently and securely floating in the provisions of his own mother's womb. So young, so needy, and from his standpoint, he's all soul because he doesn't even know that he has a body. He begins to know that he has a voice that cries for basic needs, and the warm eyes of his mother always seem to be on him when those needs are met. These are constant affirmations that his needs will be met as he begins to collect data and securities about his very being. His soul begins to become filled with a positive consistency, a catalyst for growth, now out of the haven of the womb. As the days creep by, he'll eventually become more aware of his physical self, as he will feel the warmth of his mother's breast, and his little hands will soon pass before his own eyes involuntarily, as he eventually becomes aware that he can actually make that happen himself. This interchange puts forth a transformation which often is the beginning of an awareness that will eventually lead to a more profound understanding of self or self-knowledge. We proceed out of infancy and into our childhood. We come to know that our mothers were not born the day we were born as moms, that they were once a baby too. We mature into questions that spur introspection, a calling to examine our very own existence, and onward in the process, our role in this thing called life. We find through the feedback of others what people think of us, we are told what is good about us, and what needs to be fixed, and we discern what it is we think we should do with regards to that feedback. We find that I, the soul with my name, can do this, and I can do that. Therefore, I am. In fact, I am this, and I am that, That is self-knowledge. It is when the soul properly leads and directs the body that we truly encounter self-knowledge, independence, hence masculinity, through those very actions, because a soul led properly takes us to challenges that require resolve and move us more profoundly into the enhancement of the integrity of our masculine journey. Introspection plunges into our inner core, the soul, and finds our strengths and our weaknesses. It is when we understand and accept these incredible characteristics that make us so unique to any being in the history of the universe and put our strengths to work that we begin to fulfill the earthly purpose of our very soul. That is independence. We must come to know the soul, then move the body in consistent fashion with it. In the journey of the male life, without this self-knowledge having ever been casted by introspection, there is no chance for our intended autonomy, our masculinity, to become realized. However, when the body instead begins to lead or move the soul, we can cause a major inner conflict, of which I will painfully and personally recall as I explain that to you here. C.S. Lewis states, "We do not have a soul." He says, we do not have a soul. He says, we are a soul. We have a body. But as a high school football player, I was overly aware of the physicalities of my life, barely recognizing that a soul existed. A boy, so dependent in every way and quietly desperate because of it. I was a body a whole lot more than I was a soul. That's the trailer. Now it's time to get some popcorn because I'm going to go into a movie that's going to affirm pretty much everything that's been said here and maybe enlighten you a little bit more to bring into the locker room and into my life. I was once an altar boy who rode his bike to Mass every weekday morning before school, often in the dark dead of winter, delivering my newspapers on the way. We talked to youth today about delivering newspapers. They're like, what? What is that? I was in love with the church, capital T, capital C, and often thought about being a priest. I would cry myself to sleep at night, thinking about the priesthood. And then the next night, I might cry about wanting to be a father. At a very young age, now as a father of 8, I just find that truly amazing now that I've seen my young boys grow, that, you know, at 8 years old myself, when this was happening, 8 through 10 years old, that I was gifted with such great love for our Lord and a devotion to Him. I don't know where it came from. My soul was leading my body independently without my mother or anyone else by my side. I was waking myself up. I have a 15-year-old that has yet to do that. And I was rising before the homes of the neighborhood lights were lit. I was fighting off chases by stray dogs. I had some pretty bad scrapes out there all by myself before the sun even rose. I had freezing hands while I was handing the wine and water to the priest for consecration, being sure that I satisfied my customers at the same time because it was the right thing to do, all while gaining my greatest honor, which was the title of Monsignor by our pastor. Say, good morning, Monsignor. Good morning, Monsignor. The town I grew up in was founded upon football. Our football coach, Warren Wolf, also served as mayor and assistant superintendent of schools. When I was 10 years old, I found out that I was eventually going to watch football games in high school or I was going to play the game. One or the other. I was going to be there. Was either going to be on the field or I was going to watch it because that town was all about football. My father was an only child who was left by his father at age 3. He and my mother had 5 children. In spite of his horrible role model, who left my father and grandmother for another woman, I truly believe my father lived in complete fidelity to my mother. He was a World War II vet who lied about his age and independently against his mother's wishes fought the war as a 16-year-old man. After the war, he met Mom and took his own mother into his household and provided for her for the rest of her life. When I asked my father at age 10 if I could play football, he made sure that it happened. Was he a role model? Yes. Was he a mentor? perhaps, but I was not listening to him. If he was a mentor, he was surely not an intentional mentor. He was, after all, especially when I was a teenager, my dad, in my mind, he had nothing to offer me. I wondered often in my later years if it was my grandmother, Nana, we called her, that raised him into manhood. I suffered with a fallout from my disrespect for him well after his death. He was sometimes disrespectful to my mother in the way he spoke to her, and he was very demanding. That always bothered me. But as I got older, I began to realize that he was in fact miraculous given the abandonment of his own father in Depression-era times. But so was she a miracle. My father gave as much as he could. He gave a real lot to us, especially considering the excuses he could have chosen to do otherwise. So I'm thankful that he was my dad. I honor him today. But gentlemen, I didn't come to these terms with my dad until I confessed my dishonor for my father. You know, honor thy mom and dad, I believe, is the first commandment after the ones that have to do directly with God the Father in heaven go straight to family. I didn't become whoever I am today until I confessed that. And I can talk to my father freely now in heaven because of it. And I've asked him for forgiveness. And I've forgiven him. I eventually played high school football for Coach Wolf and played quarterback at 5'8" tall. I was chosen over 4 senior quarterbacks, none of them under 6 feet tall. My journey was often related to the biblical David in the quiet confines of my heart. I love the story of David in my heart. I was David all the time. I got my energy from the story of David. And as I now look back, there really are profound resemblances far beyond David who, you know, slew the giant. David was chosen by God himself to become king, and he was far from the forefront of his older, larger, stronger brood of 8 masculine-looking brothers to take on a huge, monumental task. God said to Samuel, "Do not look on his face nor on the height of his body, for I have not chosen him. Man judges by the outward looks, but God looks at the heart." Our football program had a fully developed winning tradition, the best in the state of New Jersey. And as players, we would just lunge into it, let ourselves be led and coached by a truly great football coach, and sit back and rest on the laurels and the victories of Brick Township football. He was the winningest coach in the history of the state of New Jersey. Didn't lose a football game in my high school career. Lost one. But to me, it's not a loss, because it was cut short with about 2 minutes left because of a riot in the middle of the field. We were behind by a touchdown. And Brick football players always won. We were going to win that game. But it was so easy for me. It was a done deal proposition. I was an overachiever that won multiple honors in spite of my stature. But my coach loved my heart, like God loved David's. And he commissioned me to take an incredible responsibility. And that was to lead an amazingly successful tradition and slay the biggest giants in the state of New Jersey. Coach Wolf traveled all over the state and played the best. I was leading my team to championships with the very same heart that got me out of bed every morning, no matter what the temperature, got on my bike and did some very difficult things every day. Coach Wolf saw that heart. And he also gave me a glimpse of true independence when, for the first time, what would become a very storied, legendary career, he allowed me to call audibles. Yeah. On the line of scrimmage, and back in 1973, this was very uncommon, especially on the high school level. And little did I know at the time, but it would later save my life. He was a mentor through modeling, and yet not an intentional one like my father. He was the guy that was responsible for giving me what was at the time the greatest times of my life. He gave me what I thought was my manhood. I truly felt alive and invigorated when I played football. I had any girl I wanted. I had prom dates come to me. I had any girl I wanted to date, for the most part, and I'm not talking about the kind of dates that I would want my daughters to go on. My football jacket was my badge of honor. I was the man. I let myself become founded upon a collection of superficial data. I was extremely aware of one thing, myself. My body was leading my soul to look at every mirror, reread all my newspaper clippings and become extremely dependent on affirmations, storytelling, girls, and self-glory. I stopped going to Mass. I stopped praying. And my soul became smaller and smaller and smaller as Dan Duddy, jersey number 7, got bigger than life in my own eyes only. I went to college. I found out that my jacket had no glory in college. In fact, it meant that I was a jerk if I wore it. So I had benefited from a superficial glory that did not have much to do with anything that really I did personally. College students, those that stayed and did not retreat home to maintain their independent boyhood status, seemed like complete strangers to me because I was a complete unidentifiable stranger to my own self. I spent many, many hours for 4 years in desperate darkness, struggling every single day, and even considered suicide a few times. When the jacket came off, I was naked, didn't know anything about myself. I puked blood once due to the dry heaves of stress and having absolutely zero self-knowledge. I went home every single weekend while in college to date a high school girl who was so inflamed with me since her freshman year, although I didn't know her at the time. I dated her since my sophomore year of college, and it surely postponed any level of independence at all of true manhood. She was the numbing medication of denial and nothing more. My coach then hired me to become a football coach at Brick Township High School, so I was right back to my school colors. I was, forgive the term, right back to the warm breast of my coach, and I was a varsity football coach. I started to see my friends grow, guys. I started to go to their weddings. I started to go to babies' christenings. I started to go to housewarming parties. And I started to really become called out of this, what I consider to be almost a sickness of prolonged boyhood. I started to become very uncomfortable with myself. I asked the girl who I had actually bought an engagement ring for her, and I had no idea what a husband and a father was. I didn't know who I was, but eventually I asked her after these rites of passage that I saw my friends go through, my beer buddies, who no longer answer my phone calls for beers. I said to her, "How many kids would you like to have?" She said, "There will never be a parasite in this womb." She said, "There will never be a parasite in this womb." That was death at the door of my manhood. That's where I really had to find out who the heck I was. And from that point forward, I moved on. At age 27, I began to feel some things that really outweighed my cowardice. I reached back to the same football experience that was my demise and found the strength I needed. I called my own audible. I took a risk and I dropped her, never to see her again. That was the beginning of my manhood. It took introspection. It was uncomfortable. I had to go inside. I had to fight the demons that were stopping me from living my life. I had to put them aside for the first time and go inside and make a very difficult decision. And you know who I found? I found an 8-year-old boy. I found the guy that was getting out of bed every morning, getting on his bike, delivering newspapers, and helping a priest consecrate. And getting back to his home, and getting on a bus, I started to get a whiff of him again. And realizing that nobody else on the bus was doing that, or maybe could do that, or have the desire to that. And it rekindled that. See, I was an 8-year-old man. And then I became a 19-year-old boy. I was taking. Men give, boys take. So I started to head toward uncharted waters. I felt like I had something to give to the world. So I went to my coach and I said, "Coach, you know, I want to coach freshman football. I want to get out of the varsity scene. I want my own football team. I don't care if it's a freshman team, younger guys," which really took some sucking up of my ego and to give up all those championships that were being won, but they weren't being won by me. And I said, "I want to now get into the locker room and coach freshman football." And he said, "Sure, Dan, go for it. We're going to miss you." But I think he knew. I think he knew. So I started to realize that I could inspire guys. The kids really started listening to my talks. Kids did what I asked them to do. And you see, I really started to feel my manhood. I really started to feel an effect and a powerful influence on the world because mothers are coming to me and saying, Coach, I really like what you're saying to my sons. You're really changing the attitudes of my sons in the house. And I was like, wow, but they're changing me. And she said, you know, you're really turning my son into a man. And I was like, me leading a son? But it was the players that really led me to me. That's the interchange that I'm trying to express to you. My coach always say, you know, after talking about a kid who wasn't really getting it done in practice and was shying away from contact drills, always, you know, the sprained pinky was keeping him out of practice, you know, because it was due to an over-coddling mom, Coach Wolf would always say, you know, it's the mother that makes the man. And I believe that truly it's the manly father that makes the man, provided the mother doesn't undo the father's work. Now, today is another whole argument. Our fathers aren't in the house. You know, there are 2,049 stadiums, I heard recently in another gentleman's talk, that hold 40,000 people or more in the United States of America. Every single one of those seats can be filled with a fatherless boy. And I was always impressed with the Spartan women and their role in raising men. The warriors were out in the field, and the Spartan women were the ones that trained them. You know, and that's not the antithesis of the things that have been expressed here. That's a woman who holds masculinity in such a high regard that she's completely in support of masculinity for her husband and the father, and assertively, you know, sends him into vicious warfare. I wonder sometimes if Nana, my father's mother, was a little bit Spartan. I fell in love with a beautiful woman named Moore who insisted I come back to my faith if I was ever even going to date her. I really wanted to date her. I was a bartender. I was doing a lot of wrong things. And I met her blue eyes, and me being who I was at the time, was still living at home. And I said, Mom, I found my wife. And she was the worst cocktail waitress. She was a cocktail waitress. She had just come from the missions. She was the worst cocktail waitress I ever saw in my life. And she got fired, but she claims that she quit. To this day, that's a discussion. But I followed her right out of that place. And I never went back. She was from 8 children with the oldest, just about to be ordained a priest. We have mutual friends here, some of us know that. Her father was an incredible guy, a union plumber. He had 10 thumbs, strong guy. Awesome sight to see those rosary beads in his hands. He just wore his faith on his sleeve. But she insisted on a very pure premarital relationship that was the beginning of a personal transformation. That was hard for me. That was extremely hard for me. I was in such bad habits when it came to women. Bad, bad habits. And I really thought that was masculinity. I thought that was manhood. My resolve to purity with her caused a whole lot of much-needed introspection regarding my own chastity. And it moved my soul ahead of my body for the first time in a long time. Now my soul was beginning to lead my body. She insisted I go to confession with her. And she joked with me about how long my penance was as she waited in the back of the church when the lights were getting shut off. Whereas a couple of months before that, before I met her, I used to curse when the lights came on at the bars because that means I couldn't have any more beers. Whole different meaning to lights. 5 months later, we were married by her brother. I knew her for 8 months. I then admitted to her that the penance that the priest gave me was for 30 days straight. That's the truth. The priest was tough on me, but he saw something, and so did she. But I knew myself enough through the game of football. Thank God I cut through all the glitz and glamour of the phony, superficial garbage I was getting from the culture. I got enough from it that I made that audible and I married her. I loved what she saw in my soul. Thank God she saw it, truly. And then I had a plan for my soul. You know, she kind of led me to confession, and then she stepped aside and said, go, Dan, now lead me. David said in his bleeding heart confession in Psalm 51, after a chain of sins, having started with going in with Bathsheba, have mercy on me, God, in accord with your merciful love. And later, he said, a clean heart create for me, God, renew me with a steadfast spirit. I became a new man. I was independent of the ties of my past, and she trusted me because of her faith in the sacrament of confession. I became free due to forgiveness. Forgiveness is the virtue that made me a man and one that real men give. Yes, I know that men and women are capable of giving forgiveness, as my wife did for me, but it is the independence launched from it that made me, David, and all men new. We are married now after 32 years and with 8 children. But shortly after that, I found a job as a head football coach. I took it upon myself to apply for it without any discussion with her. I was sitting having my coffee at school, read a newspaper article about a coach resigning down the road a little bit, and we were really, really strapped for money. We were having our 5th child, and I went and applied for it. And I got the job because I came from that story program. And little did I know, outside of the insulated walls of Brook Township Football, that there was a reputation out there about me. It had nothing to do with me. It's just the way the culture looked at the successes of the school. And I was a quarterback. So I got hired. We bought my kingdom, 900 square foot bungalow. We called it a cottage. I was really starting to live my manhood. And I was now coaching at a school where it was different colors, one that I did not play for. And I was finding truly myself. In my first year as a head coach, a player entered my life and changed my life completely. We were practicing, we were having a hard-hitting drill, a one-on-one drill, and it was extremely lively, and it was vicious. And I coached some really, really, really tough kids at this high school. And they were white, lower middle class, blue-collar kids, and they just couldn't wait to strap it on a hit. And I couldn't stop these guys from hitting. That's a good problem for a coach to have. Well, up in the top of the hill came running down this African-American kid, and he was jacked. I mean, he was a stud. So the drill went on and continued. You couldn't stop these kids from hitting if you wanted to. And I took a turn outside to go meet the kid, and I said, how are you? I'm Coach Duddy. And he said, I'm Louis C. Brown III. I said, boy, I pictured 3 generations of this kid. So we had a conversation. He said, I'm a transfer. I've come to play football. I didn't hesitate at all. So you have your papers? You know, you need physical. You need to, boom, papers, ready to go. So I threw my keys to an assistant coach, and I said, Louis, follow the coach up there, get your equipment. Well, the coach had to run behind Louis. Louis went up and got his gear, came back in the drill. Usually, typically a kid, and you watch this all the time, when you're doing one-on-one drills and you're facing single file like this, boom, boom, next 2 guys up, boom, boom, you'll see a lot of kids look to see who he's matched up with, right, Mark? Yeah. And you see him back up and you say, that kid's not a player. So this kid got in line, and I'm watching him, and he's looking, and he's stepping up, and he's doing this. He's stepping up, he's doing this. I'm going, oh, man. You know, looks like Tarzan going to be Jane, right? Well, it turned out he got up against our toughest kid, and he knocked the mouthpiece out of that kid. And it turned out later on, when I talked to Louis, I said, Louis, that was unbelievable. You know, you just knocked our best player. I said, Coach, I was looking for the alpha male. I was looking for the alpha male because I needed to really, I'm a black guy on a white team, and I really needed to show my stuff. And boy, did he ever. He became an unbelievable football player for us, obviously, as a sophomore in high school. Louis injured his neck in his junior year. It was a season-ending injury. Well, my coach, Coach Wolf, would always make it a point to go to the hospitals when kids got hurt. Well, this happened at a time where I couldn't get to the hospital, and he was then home, and I found out he was home, and he was going to get tutored, and he couldn't come to school anymore. He had a neck brace on. I went to visit his house. I get to his house. He lives in an apartment with broken down cars, beer bottles on the ground, garbage all over the place, and he's not even living in my district. Now I'm supposed to report that. You think I'm going to report that? The kid can play ball. So I'm supposed to report that. I knock on the door. Lewis comes down with a neck brace, says, come on in, coach. I go up to an apartment. There's nothing in this apartment. There's one bedroom with two beds, but I meet mom and a sister. And I'm looking at pictures, not too many around. There's no man in the pictures. So me and mom have a great conversation about just about Lewis and making sure his academics are going up. If there's anything I can do, you know, basically giving her my regards. I go on the way out. She says, Coach Duddy, thank you so much. You mean an awful lot to Lewis. Okay, so senior year comes around. Against his mother's wishes, he's playing in his senior year. After one practice, we got some more injuries. I said to Lewis, you got to come over here. He's got a bunch of friends here. I said, Lewis, come here. Lewis, I'm going to have to change your position. We have injuries on the offensive line, and we can't play football without an offensive line. He said, okay, coach. Whatever's best for the team. I said, you have to change your number. You wear number 41. You have to change your number to an ineligible number. He screamed, that's bullshit. He snapped, turned around, showed me all the disrespect in the world. His teammates were watching. I went to grab his shoulder to turn him, threw an elbow at me, and he marched right through his team up into the locker room. So I get up in the locker room and I say, there'll be no prima donnas in this team. Team comes first. I don't want to hear it. If you don't like what's going on, you're going to have to leave. On the way out, I'm standing in the locker room. The players are walking by me, which was a habit that I always had. I said goodbye to every single player and looked them in the eye. Lewis waited till the end. So I figured this was going to be a fallout, big time. Lewis looks me in the eye, and he says, we need to talk, coach. I said, I'd come to my house tomorrow. We had practice at 10, breakfast at 8 o'clock at my house. So he comes to my house. I got my kids sitting on the couch. You know, they're all in their pajamas, the boys. Lewis comes walking in. I'm just finishing up eggs and bacon for him. I have this island. He sits down. His jacked biceps, triceps sits down. I slide the plate over to him. He pushes the plate, almost smashes it against the wall. And he said, you were talking to me, coach. I said, yeah, I was talking to you. You're completely disrespectful to me. You don't know me. That's him talking to my house. My kids stopped, turned the TV off. I said, kids, go upstairs. Lewis, calm down. Coach, tears come out of his eye, start to run down his cheek. You have no idea who I am, coach. I run to practice because we don't have a car. I run home to practice because we don't have a car. You don't know that. I don't want anybody to know that. That would be embarrassing to me and my mother. My father left me when I was 8 years old, left us flat. I do not live in the same home for more than 3-4 months because we can't pay the rent. I work at Wendy's to pay bills. I never see my mother. Mom works when I'm with Virginia, his sister, and I work when Mom's with Virginia. You have no idea who I am. I'm no prima donna. No one on this football team would do what I'm doing. So I came around and I gave him a hug, and it was like hugging a corpse. And I said, Lewis, I didn't know. And he said, I said to him, why didn't you tell me? And he said, because you never asked. You never asked. I said, Lewis, I love you. And I gave him a kiss on his forehead. I didn't even kiss my own sons. And it turned into a snot bubble cry, if you know what I mean. That 6'2" kid went on to Lafayette on a full scholarship. His head went here, and he cried snot bubbles. And I said, I will never, ever, ever not ask for the rest of my high school coaching career. So I became intentional. I became intentional about my coaching. That's when I started to go to the hearts and souls of our players. Lewis is very, 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 very real to me to this very day. He had a self-knowledge that came from an extreme amount of discomfort that forced him into an independence and a manliness that was beyond mine and that was never revealed to me before in the game of football. The amount of introspection for Lewis to be who he was, a full-time football player and a full-time leader, provider, and protector from I don't know what age is unimaginable to me. Far more a man at his age 16 than I surely was. My football life was way too easy for me. You know, shortly after that busted open, I started to go to the Blessed Sacrament. And, you know, Matthew Kelly, you know, his core principle is, you know, 10 minutes in a classroom of silence to become the best version of yourself. So I went to the Blessed Sacrament a lot more than 10 minutes. I was struggling big time with not being able to practice my faith any longer because I was really being called to faith in football. And I was in a public school at the time with Lewis. God told me to quit. Flat out said, quit coaching. I said, what? So I went back to for a second opinion. He told me the same thing. So in the virtue of obedience, I quit. I went home and told my wife that I'm done with football. 1 year later, I was boldly practicing Catholicism and football at a local parochial school. I took the year off, driving my wife crazy. I got a phone call from the athletic director 6 minutes away. I said, would you like to be head football coach here at Donovan Catholic High School? That's where God wanted me to go. And I did. And I coached my sons there. I coached many sons to be better men there. I built a model for the Catholic Athletes for Christ because of my experiences at Donovan Catholic High School, where we boldly, you know, teach manhood. And you know, we're in 100 high schools now, that model. This bonehead here is now in 100 high schools through the Catholic Athletes for Christ. You know, just a great revelation came not too long ago that, thank God, the 12 disciples were not all, you know, graduates of the University of Jerusalem. I can truly relate to them. You know, one time on a Monday afternoon, a father of a player was waiting for me to come toward the parking lot after practice, and that's never a good thing. And he looked kind of humble and quiet, which is uncommon when fathers want to meet a head coach off the... And he said, Coach, I got to tell you something. And you could see he was humble but yet proud. He said, Brian woke us all up yesterday, Sunday. And he said, get up. We're all going to Mass. And he said, Coach, I haven't been to Mass since my wedding. He said, I had a 16-year-old man wake us up. And he said, get up, get out of bed. And his sister, too. And he even cooked breakfast for us. And I said, that's a beautiful thing. And that was after a lesson on boldness through the Catholic Athletes for Christ. See, Brian stepped up, got out of his comfort zone, required a whole lot of introspection, and became the man of the house. He brought his father to manhood. I don't think they've missed Mass since, and that was quite a while ago. In February of 2014, at 3 o'clock in the morning, two police officers showed up in my living room. My son Keenan woke us up, said, Dad, there's two cops downstairs. I've had cops at my door before, usually for shooting off bottle rockets or something like that. My wife kind of like, you know, startled a little bit and mumbled, and I said, more, I got this. I put my jeans on, I went downstairs. And as I was going down the stairs, I saw the cops in the shadows of the living room, and I said, you guys have me really nervous. and there was no urgency in their face. I turned the corner, came around. As I got closer to them, they moved further. And I got close in front of them, and they said, "Are you Mr. Duddy, the father of Francis Duddy?" And I didn't want to say yes. I said yes. He said, "I'm sorry to tell you, but your son is gone. He died in a car accident 2 hours before." The driver was a teammate of Francis's, and they were both on my football team. I coached my son. Francis was 1 year removed at age 19. Connor was 18, and I had coached him the season before. I can't even truly put into words like the darkness and the anger and the resentment and the hatred that came flying out of me during the week that followed. At one point, my wife went to get the suits and the dresses and stuff for the siblings, my other sons and daughters, for the funeral of their brother. And I had my time with the Lord, and it wasn't pretty, because I had been surrounded by thousands of people, and it was very comforting, but now I was alone. I don't know why, but it just happened. And I stood at the bottom of the stairs, and I yelled up the stairs Francis's name 3 times, just hoping that he would come down those stairs. And I just wanted to really yell his name. I wanted to say it as many times as I could, and then I turned and I said, "You know, God, what is up with this? I pray to you every single night to bring my son home, bring all my kids home safely. I pray the Lord's Prayer, thy will be done. What's all this about? I give you my life. I listen to you. I'm doing this Catholic stuff with our football players, and this is bullcrap, this is unfair, blah, blah, blah." And sat down, and I had an unbelievable cry. And I heard a voice, I heard a feeling, I got this feeling. And the Lord said, "Dan, Francis is my son. He's my son." And he said, "And you know what, Dan, you're my son." And he said, "My will was done, and he's home safely." Well, a little while later, you know, I mean, I got a tremendous feeling of gratitude that I ever had the boy. I was put totally and entirely in my place. I was a spoiled boy, thinking that I had been done wrong, until, thank God, I got that revelation from our Lord. And I decided that I was going to lead my family as the man that I professed to be all that time. It was time for me to put up or shut up. So when the family came home, we had a meeting around the table. And I said, "From this point forward, as a family, a community, because we are leading, not only my family, but the community as a man, the whole community of thousands of people that came to his wake and his funeral, the whole sports community. I have 7 college athletes. The network is incredible. And they all came to see what are the Duddies going to do. Yes, pay their homages and pray, I get that, but they were all wanted to see how the Duddies were going to handle this. I had a responsibility to my family that we were going to forgive. I had a responsibility to my own soul that we were going to forgive. I was forgiven. And as a man, after that harsh introspection, I found a masculinity about myself by the grace of God only that provided forgiveness to this kid, Connor. And me and my son, Danny, went to court. And we said in court, it's even online, we're here in the name of Jesus Christ. We're here to forgive you. Because no man can truly become alive without forgiveness. And Connor, in order for us to live and for you to live, you can't do that without our forgiveness, and we're going to need to do it every day. And the level of the pain is commensurate with the level of the forgiveness, and we've given you a high level of forgiveness. I said, if we're going to call ourselves men, that is leaders, providers, and protectors, then we need to be able to live. Mark, Dr. Chavez, my Into the Wild retreat stays with me forever. And my son Danny, who went to court with me at age 26, was at your Into the Wild retreat, I think your first one. How old was Danny then? Do the math for me.
2009, so this is 5 years later, so he was 21.
Yeah. 20. Yeah. Yeah. And what a man he became. You know, he said, "Dad, we got to do this." I said, "You're right, Dan, let's do it." Yeah. Yep. So we were all set free that day. And beyond myself being set free, this is manhood at its best. The whole community was set free because a man made a manly decision, but it was founded on his pain. I wasn't going to be able to live with it unless I just got drunk. I'd be drunk right now probably if I hadn't. So we let it go. And now, although Connor's behind bars for 42 months as opposed to the 18 years that he was supposed to get, he's been set free. He cannot wait to get out. He's speaking in schools and so forth and getting it done out there. Lewis stayed in contact with me, Lewis C. Brown III, throughout the whole process. Lewis came from Atlanta, Georgia, to be with us and went back. Lewis witnessed everything. About a year ago, Lewis's father, who he was in complete denial of talking to and only had extremely harsh, angry words for, reached out to Lewis. Lewis's dad was from Virginia, was going to New Orleans. He had a new family for his daughter's gymnastics meet in New Orleans. Called Lewis in Atlanta, said, "I find out that we have one extra day. I thought the gymnastic meet was going to be on such and such a date, but it's a day later. Lewis, would you please let me come and visit you?" Lewis said, "Yes, Dad." So the dad drove to Atlanta, knocked on the door. Lewis opened the door and said, "Dad, welcome." Gave his dad a kiss. He said, "Dad, I love you and I forgive you." And they had the most incredible hug that could ever be. Gentlemen, I even hesitate to tell you this because it's an incredible story, but it's absolutely true. Lewis, his kingdom, his dad, that Lewis had built entirely by himself, took dad and his new wife to the guest room, kissed his father on the forehead, same way I kissed Lewis. They had a chuckle about that. His father passed away of an apparent heart attack right there. The next morning, the woman woke up and said, "Lewis, your dad won't wake up." Lewis gave him CPR, the whole works, and the ambulance rode him away. He was pronounced dead. If that's not proof of the existence of God, I don't know what is. Wow. Is that something? Lewis is a great example of manhood being formed in the natural order. But he also converted to a devoted Catholic with his wife. And I'm the godfather of his first child in Catholic baptism. You know, the moment that, and Lewis said in a recent conversation, he said, "Coach, you taught me how to be a father and a husband." He said, "You taught me manhood." He said, "I'm a thermostat. I'm not a thermometer. I change the temperature. I'm not subjected to it." And Lewis taught me the same. Amen. Thanks,
fellas. Amen.
All right, Dan. Unbelievable. Thank you. Thank you for staying up here. Thank you for sharing the stories. Those are, they teach so much, and yet the heart hemorrhaging before us is just a great lesson as well. So let's talk about formation of the boy through sports, through Dan's life, through the coach that he had, through the stories you just heard, questions that you have for Dan about sports, maybe even follow up to some of the things he said. I wrote down a few things. I have questions as usual, but I'll defer to you. So only take 10 minutes to ask Dan some questions. Or Catholic Athletes for Christ, if you want to.
Yeah, anything you want to get off that. I know that was dramatic. Yes.
Yeah, Dan, what do you think? I mean, why does Catholic Athletes for Christ have that kind of success with 100 high schools? What do you think are its main components which give it traction?
Well, it's definitely, because it's intentional. And what the Catholic Athletes for Christ does, it's founded on what we call Catholic sessions, where it takes the whole body of Catholics in the building and creates a community of Catholics and injects an identity, a Catholic identity, into the athletic body. So we meet every 2 weeks, and we show to them, provided by a moderator, resources, lessons that are provided by the Catholic Athletes for Christ. And it goes right to the athletic heart. It starts with a sports story that is analogous to a Bible verse. And every lesson has references to the sacraments and the catechism. But moreover, above all that, it ends with a provocation to dialogue. So kids now are coming outside their skin, and they're starting to converse about their faith. But it ends with a resolution to action. And we ask for it to be a resolution, you know, to something that's a little bit outside of their comfort zone. So essentially what it does, it takes the gospel and makes it alive on the playing fields. But what happens is, and there's no other model like this that creates unity amongst the whole athletic body in our schools. I think I have a right to say that in 38 years of coaching. Nothing else does that consistently every 2 weeks. There are initiatives that come out of that energy that you don't even see. We have a dedication or devotion to life in the womb that came from one of our lessons. So now we're taking busloads of kids to the March for Life. Mm. We also have a kid who raised his hand once and said, you know, Coach, we're talking about the Eucharist. We're talking about the power of the Eucharist and the presence of our Lord. How come we don't have team masses every day then in our lecture hall? We have a chapel there. I said, go talk to the principal. We have team masses every day in our school now because a student athlete stepped up and asked for it. So that's what comes from the energy. But it really comes from an injection of an identity. You know, it really comes from a moderator saying, look, if you're going to call yourself a football player or a swimmer, you got to practice it. You can't tell me you're a football player if you're not going out on the field and putting a helmet on. You're going to call yourself a Catholic, you know what I'm saying. If you're going to say you're a Catholic, you got to be Catholic. Let's learn what Catholic is. You know, so athletes love to be commissioned. You know, we talked about David and the anointment and, you know, the catalyst for it. Athletes love to be knighted. They love to be commissioned. They love to have a problem put in their hands. You know, so when you take the Catholic Church and you define whatever the status we believe the Catholic Church is in today, right, wrong, or different, or if it's dilapidated or if it's not, if it needs to be reconstructed, just no matter what, put it into an athlete's hands, you know, and commission them. I think that problem that we have from age 18 to 25, I hope and I pray, is going to become fulfilled, and those kids will continue to practice their faith through college and beyond. You know, we're talking about fathers and husbands. We're talking about the future of our families. And I think where our families are strong, the church is strong. So we need to really go right after the hearts of our families.
Dan, I have a question. In light of my own experience and also some reservations that parents have, even in allowing their children to play football, you've noticed in the last 10 years or so a great awareness of injuries, head injuries. You notice those things. The migraines that the kids are getting, but also the brain damage, when you get the bruises,
concussions.
And so parents are very hesitant to allow, even, and the kids are even starting to play football at a very younger age. Even peewees are, you know, my son's going to enter, and he's in second grade, he's going to enter into full contact next year, or he'll be in third grade. That's even sooner than when I did it. How do you feel about the state of young boys playing sports at a young age, one, and what's the benefit of that, or is there a danger to that? And two, how do you best encourage a boy to be a part when you have all this going on the periphery, which is my kid's gonna get hurt. Like, how do you best navigate that? Because I think a lot of parents say, they overprotect. It's exactly what it is. Overprotect, like Dave said last night.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, when we have moms and dads who, especially in the teenage years, turn their boys over to be formed by other men, there's a great deal of wisdom in that. I also feel that at the younger age, you know, I don't know if football is the best thing for our young people to do, you know, because, you know, truly at a young age, you get a lot of what's called daddy ball. You know, you get a lot of, fathers who are in it for the wrong reasons or aren't trained. You know, and training is an issue with our coaches. So, you know, they need to be trained towards, you know, building, you know, the masculine soul of the athletes that are in their keep, truly in their keep. Now, I have a son who's 15 years old who I haven't put on a football field or let him play football since. Now, it has nothing to do with the concussion syndrome. I mean, that's truly a safety issue. And in fact, you know, there's no helmet that can protect us from concussions. Kids are getting bigger, stronger, and faster because everyone's got a personal trainer and their dieting is making them bigger, stronger, and faster. So the gray matter smashes into the skull because of a speed issue and inertia. It has nothing to do with the helmet. That's a tough one. I think the game does have to become, you know, more safe. It's a hard one to argue. But also, I think we're at greater risk by stopping kids from getting the brotherhood that comes from the game of football, you know, out of fear of concussions. You know, kids are still playing. Mark, you played. You've had your bell rung a few times, I'm sure, right? If you've had it rung by others, and you had it rung by hitting others. And, you know, my helmet, I don't know how I even survived the game. My helmet is just like a shell. But there's more damage to our young people that are over-coddled by moms than there is by a concussion.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Now, you bring up the brotherhood, sorry, as a quick follow-up. You bring up the brotherhood. Can you talk a little bit about, like, you know, what that does to the heart of a boy, like the camaraderie?
I can give you an example of it. Yeah. You know, I'm hand-painting a sign in my backyard my first year as a head coach when I said goodbye to Coach Wolf. By the way, I didn't tell you this, but when I applied for that job and I got that job, Coach Wolf called me up right away. And I thought for sure, you know, he said, Coach, come on. He said to me, he always called me Coach, come on over. He's 92 years old, and I still have lunch with him every once in a while. He called me to come to his house, and I was envisioning the whole way, you know, this is going to be a great talk. You know, he's going to talk to me for hours. He's going to pat me on the back. He's going to give me a whole lot of wisdom. And I knocked on the door, and he didn't invite me in. He said, come to the garage. I went to the garage, and he gave me a ring, a handmade ring, and he said, be yourself. He said, be yourself, you know? And just those two words. And he stared at me like, what? And I shook hands and left. You know, so that was a beautiful thing. You know, where were we going?
Brotherhood.
When I got the first job, I hand-painted a sign in the back of that bungalow/cottage, and it said, we will, period. I underlined we. And I hung it from our goalpost, practice goalpost, on a shoestring, literally shoestring. It's all I had, you know. And the wind eventually knocked it down. I hung it up in the locker room, and the kids started to touch it. Bang, they hit it. And it became a unifying anointment, commission. Every single day they came in and they left, they started to touch that sign. I said, that's turning into something. Mark, I only hung it there to get it off the practice field. The boys naturally started to bond to it. I heard at Into the Wild retreat that the reason why dogs are a man's best friend because they both travel in packs. That was you. And I felt the pack. And this was a vastly regional school. So I needed to do something that bonded them together because the neighborhoods weren't bonding them. Brick Township was founded on neighborhoods, cohesive neighborhoods. Well, the boys said, do something, coach. So we took that sign down and we had them sign it. We had them commissioned to it. We had a right. And we called it, our fraternity called it Brave Heart. It was founded on William Wallace, you know, and, you know, stepping up. And so it was called the Brave Heart Brotherhood. One day I was in the coach's room and I had listened to the sign wobble, you know, kids hit it. See you later, coach. That's it. And to hear the sign, boom, ba boom, ba boom. It was beautiful. So now I'm breaking down film. I'm in the film room for about an hour and a half, getting ready for the game. I hear the locker room door open and I hear ba boom. So what the heck is that? Someone's coming to break in the locker room. So I leave the coach's room and I open the door and there's a kid getting in the pickup truck. And I said, Sean, what are you doing? He said, I forgot to touch the sign, coach. Came back an hour and a half later. How's that for brotherhood?
I love it.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And good.
Thank you for an amazing sharing. I'm very grateful for that. I was a chaplain for two different high schools for 3 years each, so 6 years total, and became convinced somewhere along the way that the most influential adults in the building were the coaches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very, very clearly in that sort of thing. And so it became my mission at that point that if the coaches were intentional about forming the faith, then a lot of good things could happen.
Amen.
So I'm just curious with Catholic Athletes for Christ, is there any type of like training for coaches on how to be intentional in forming?
Yeah, we personally train. I mean, I was in Green Bay, Wisconsin 2 weeks ago to train their coaches, and Norwich, Connecticut the week before to do that. Absolutely the most influential people in our young people's lives because we put them on. We are a symbol of freeing them up in their most desirous moment. You know, I say this to our coaches, and I don't know if this isn't going to commission a Catholic coach, I don't know what is. The 12 had to like go on the stormy seas. They had to march across land in tattered sandals. They had to go seek. They had to go find. And they literally died for it. Martyrs. We have kids begging to get on our rosters. We have kids trying out to get in our keep. And if we're going to call ourselves Catholic men and women, you know, if that's not a calling, I don't know what is. Mm-hmm. Like, really step up or get out, especially if you're in a Catholic high school. You know, and they're all eyes and they're all ears. And, you know, there's great transformation from our coaches because of it, you know.
Wonderful.
Yeah, the platform of sports is so influential.
Are you in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia?
Yeah, we're on our way. Yep. Right. We have a kickoff event coming this spring. It was supposed to be in October, but great. It's getting pushed back till the spring. So we're going to go diocesan-wide through a woman who's on our board through the Philadelphia First Foundation. So I don't know if we're going to go through all 17 high schools right away. That's sure. not an easy thing to do. The human dynamic keeps getting in the way. But
we have the interesting thing in Birmingham, where football is football in Birmingham.
Deal. Yeah.
Our commander, actually, I just had this conversation in the summer. My formation, my growth is not in sports. It's in sort of alternative living. That's not what I said. But we had this great conversation about sports because, in a sense, you know, in a lot of places, fraternities, the biggest complaint is, well, we can't compete with sports.
Mm-hmm.
And they see themselves in competitions because they perceive the coaches as giving a bad influence spiritually, which we talked about yesterday, that is often the case.
Yeah.
But he has taken a pretty extreme stance. His point is that what sports have become now is so extreme than what's being expected of younger and younger ages. Practicing every day and practicing on Sundays, that it is no longer a viable option for good formation because it's extreme. Which I took his position as a little bit extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
But I guess he had actually started what I now know is Birmingham's largest, middle school and elementary school sports program. He actually started it, and he says, "I repent every day because I'm ripping families apart."
Yeah. Let me tell you something. Can I just cut in on you? Regarding sports ripping families apart, it could easily rip my family apart. You know, because my wife goes that way with kids and I go that way. But now they're a little bit older, so we've kind of grown through that. But there was a time in our life we didn't see each other because kids had to be on their schedules. Our family was all about the coaches' schedules. And even more so, the coaches would hold practices even later in spite of the fact that we had something else we needed to do. Like, for example, get around the dinner and say grace. You know? So I get that. So what we did through this model. I was called from Donovan Catholic to go to Trenton to build the CAC model because of what was going on with my football program when that transition from the Blessed Sacrament took place. We created a mentoring program that is theme-based, and I told you about this, and I want to share it. We would take a theme, a virtue theme of the week, and we would lay that down on Saturday morning to our players, for example, charity. And we would take our staff, and the mathematics would work, we would divide our numbers of kids in accordance to our staff. So each coach would have 6 mentees, we'll say. And at the end of practice on Monday, the coach was told to go home Saturday, study perseverance, or charity in this case, I said, and own it, possess it, and come up with a resolution yourself in the area of charity, yourself. You come up with one, coach, for you, to get you out of your comfort zone. And then on Monday, you're going to pull a mentee to you, and you're going to express to that mentee your resolution. So I would have a mentoring group myself, and I'd say, Colin, I am going to go home this week, and I'm going to change my tone of voice with my wife. I'm going to have a much more charitable voice. I'm going to leave my football voice in the car. Very simple act, but one that I had not done before. It opened up the heart of Colin to really think about things. My relationship with him became intimate just by the sheer nature of a resolution to action in my personal life. It caused Colin to go run more deeply into himself. Colin said, I take my sister to soccer practice, and I don't listen to her. I crank my music. In fact, I have headphones on. And she goes to practice, and I sit in the car, and I'm just with my phone, blah, blah, blah. She gets back in the car, I go home. I've never had a conversation with her. I said, okay, turn the music off. Can you do that, Colin? Well, yes, coach. Turn the music off. Next week, we have another theme. Next week comes, I say, Colin, my wife really didn't tell me that things are better, but I know they're better. She's smiling more, she's more relaxed, she's more comfortable, and I feel like I can make some changes. How'd you do? He said, I found out my sister's going out with a creep. And I never would have known that if I hadn't talked to her. He's been going out with this guy for 3 months, and I know this guy, coach. I know what he wants to get from her. She told me that she's still good, and I broke it up. Never would have happened if it weren't for just taking 2-3 minutes. But I'm telling you, it would not have happened if the coach had not opened his soul and expressed a resolution. Let me tell you more. So go back to Saturday. Now, Thursday, all these kids are making resolutions. All the coaches are making resolutions. And we're all doing this together. This is the coach-player relationship that I had with Lewis. Continued. On Thursdays, we show a movie about that theme, that virtue, like Cinderella Man, something like that, that kids love, and we bring a Bible verse to it. And on Friday, that's my pregame talk. Now, you don't talk about charity before kickoff, but you do talk about loving each other and smacking people because you love each other, right? So when you go out the tunnel, I go out the tunnel. This is after I got my doctorate in coaching. You feel me?
Yep.
Not when I had my undergraduate degree. Shut up, get up, huddle up. I go out the tunnel now with my kids. I look up and down the sidelines. I've got 60 kids that resolved to a specific action in their life because of my staff, and so did my coaches. The scoreboard disappears. Disappears. We already won the game because the game is put in a different perspective. My wife goes to our banquet. She's been the football widow for 30-something years. And she's saying, Dan, I'm hearing things from your coaches. I'm hearing words come out of their mouth that I've never heard in your previous life as a football coach. That's formation. It's formation. It's in us. We're built for it. It's just a matter of getting heart to heart and practicing the fundamentals. Don't be afraid to be intimate. Be afraid of being afraid.
All right. Thanks for bringing us into your locker room, Dan. That was great. That was great. All right. Give it up for Dan. And well done. Well executed. Touchdown.
We hope you enjoy this recording from our Masculine Genius Institute Summit. This institute was founded through the collaborative effort of the King's Men and the Men's Academy. For more information and for other resources, you can visit their website at thekingsmen.org and themensacademy.org. Thank you.